you can host the best backyard barbecue. When you find a professional on Angie to make your backyard the best around. Connect with skilled professionals to get all your home projects done well. Inside to outside, repairs to renovations. Get started on the Angie app or visit Angie.com today. You can do this when you Angie that.
I was writing a lot and sending it out to everyone I knew, and can you help me? Can you send it to someone? And I had sent some stuff to David Letterman's show because a couple of friends of mine were new writers there. And they didn't hire me, but the head writer there, who I didn't even know, he handed my stuff to Mike Judge, and Mike Judge hired me to write some Beavis and Buttheads, and then I had a resume after that. So just like two people I didn't know talking ended up being the big break.
This is Sci-Fi 25 Origin Stories, a love letter to science fiction and the fans and creators who made it so, powered by Sci-Fi Wire. I'm Adam Savage, and you're about to drop into the talk I had with the otherworldly David X. Cohen. Along the way, you'll find out how he went from publishing academic papers on computer science to writing scripts about the misadventures between a binge-drinking robot and a dim-witted delivery boy. David is best known for his work, of course, as the showrunner on the science fiction comedy Futurama. And while his love of animation runs deep, having worked on The Simpsons for years, writing iconic episodes like The Treehouse of Horror and Itchy and Scratchy and Poochie Show, his love of science has equal depth, having graduated from Harvard with a major in physics. David and I begin our discussion with how his family's love for science prepared him to write about fake planets, how science fiction and comedy can intersect, and why a robot with a substance abuse problem might be the most human character in the Futurama universe. So pour yourself an ice-cold slurm as David and I head into the 31st century. Here we go. David X. Cohen, thank you so much for joining me on this podcast.
It's a pleasure.
David, in Futurama, you mix the world of science fiction with animation and comedy. I'm wondering, does that give you extra latitude for cultural commentary?
Yeah, you could comment on issues in animation and people would laugh instead of getting angry. So, yeah. Whereas if it was a live action show, people might say, oh, this guy's just lecturing and giving us his own opinion. Mm-hmm. But I think, yes, there is something to having stuff out of cartoon characters' mouths where you go, oh, I just can't take it as seriously. And that allows people to relax. And with Futurama being also science fiction, I think we had sort of two steps removed. And again, we did try to cash in on that occasionally with our episodes about, for example, legalizing robosexual marriage, or there's one about an evolutionary debate, although it's about the evolution of tiny robots into advanced robots. So this science fiction angle gives us a second avenue of distancing ourselves from these issues.
Well, that actually leads to a question I've been wanting to ask, which is after spending all those years taking the genre of science fiction and unpacking it and looking at it culturally and aesthetically, I was going to ask you about stuff that you learned that surprised you.
Perhaps the biggest lesson we learned of all was to take the science fiction seriously. Huh. Because I always felt like there's not that many things to look at in the field of comedy science fiction. So at first, when you start out, you're like, am I making fun of science fiction or is it funny science fiction? You know? So we didn't really want to make fun of it. We always wanted to go like, well, this is coming from a loving place. But to some degree, we were at the beginning trying to hold back the sci-fi a little bit because we're like, okay, people aren't going to buy into the comedy if we're also trying to tell a crazy sci-fi story.
But in terms of how much audience can just receive
it.
Aren't they
going to lose? Are they going to be too distracted to laugh? But quite the contrary, I found over the years that the more seriously we took the sci-fi and the grander, the more epic situation we could put them in, the better the comedy worked. If you can set up some real tension there, the laughs are actually bigger. The more we went along, the more we realized we don't really have to make compromises. We can try to make this real science fiction and real comedy. It's not like you have to cut corners to make one or the other.
What is your earliest science fiction memory?
Good question. I grew up in a pretty science fiction steeped household. My mom is a very heavy science fiction reader, so there were just science fiction books lying all over our house all the time. The first books I remember that made a big impression on me were Dune and these Stanislaw Lem stories. Tales of Perks the Pilot was one, and a bunch of them. And That was probably the comedy science fiction right there. Star Wars was a big thing in my childhood, too. And I remember seeing a Time magazine cover with a still from Star Wars on it before it came out. And I was like, I've got to see this thing, whatever it is. So, and then also Star Trek. Of course, my parents were both big Star Trek fans. And so I would watch, at that time, Star Trek reruns with them. But I was always more of a Star Trek person than a Star Wars person. But across the board, really, all media were coming at me when I was a kid.
I'm curious, did you want to role play in the Star Trek universe? Did you want to be a member of the crew? Is that something you imagined yourself doing?
I pictured myself being a scientist more than a superhero or a science fiction writer or a comedy writer, whatever I ended up being. But my parents were both scientists,
okay,
actual scientists, both biologists. So science fiction was big in my house, but real science was even bigger. So that was where I always thought I was going.
So when you say real science was bigger, does that mean your parents were pragmatists and they made you defend your arguments? They asked for the scientific method in approaching problem solving?
Not in such a strict way as that. It was just, it almost went without saying in my house, like, oh, science is the most interesting thing there is, you know, because my parents were passionate about it. A lot of people think of science as a dry thing, and that's never just made any sense to me at all, because I've only known people who were very passionate about it. And I went to graduate school and studied physics undergraduate and computer science as a graduate student. And people are there because they love it. So if you're in it, you realize, oh, that stereotype is just nothing like reality. I mean, it's people who are just happy to be there for the most part.
So. I tell kids all the time that among the humans that I meet, scientists are the ones that love their jobs almost universally the most.
Yeah.
They're
ecstatic. Yeah, much more so than writers, I would say.
So you went to college to be a scientist.
Yes, I was on a noble and productive path studying physics at Harvard University. Everything seemed like it was going well. And then I made a mistake that many other comedy writers made, which was I got involved with the Harvard Lampoon magazine, was writing a lot, hanging out with a lot of funny people, and came time that I was heading off to graduate school, and they were like, well, we're going to try to get jobs writing comedy. I'm like, there's jobs writing comedy? And it became this two paths diverging situation, and I went into a panic. Finally, I came to this decision. I'm going to go to graduate school, because if I don't, I'm going to forget everything I know, and I won't have that option later.
Right.
But it kept kind of nagging at me, and so I got to, when I hit kind of an end at what I was studying, that's when I took a longer, harder look at it and went, you know, I like this, but I don't love it as much as I thought. And I think I want to try writing, which it was a big jump for me, because I grew up not knowing anybody who did anything in show business. You know, I took a leave of absence from graduate school and I started writing spec scripts, which is what you do when you're trying to get a job, and sending them out. And most people have a story that even if they had some strategy for getting involved, it does take some luck. It takes persistence and luck and perhaps skill. That's maybe number three on the list. But I was, you know, writing a lot and sending it out to everyone I knew. And can you help me? Can you send it to someone? And the ultimate good luck moment was I had sent some stuff to David Letterman's show, because a couple of friends of mine were new writers there, and they didn't hire me. But Mike Judge, the creator of Beavis and Butthead, which had just come out as just a one-off thing he had done, was being made into a series by MTV. And so he was appearing as a guest on Letterman, and he was talking to the head writer there, who I didn't even know. Mike Judge was saying, I need some, you know, funny, really cheap writers. And the guy's like, oh, I read this stuff and, you know, I liked it, but David Letterman passed on it. So he handed my stuff to Mike Judge, and Mike Judge hired me to write some Beavis and Buttheads. And then I had a resume after that. So just like two people I didn't know talking ended up being the big break.
Amazing. We're here talking largely because of Futurama. And Futurama came about from your writing on Simpsons. Am I right about this? Matt Groening plucked you out of Simpsons to develop Futurama?
Yeah, I guess he looked around a room packed with huge nerds and looked at me and went, I want that nerd over there.
What was it about your nerdness?
Well, there's all different types of nerds. That's the thing. So I was just lucky to be the science fiction, science nerd at that time.
So this was it, the moment you got to combine your two loves, science fiction and comedy. I'm guessing it's no coincidence that your main character on Futurama is also a science fiction fan.
Mm-hmm. And what kind of extra layers do you get to tell because of that?
Star Trek being probably the biggest sci-fi influence on Futurama, just in terms of the setup of we're on a ship and we're traveling around and we might be anywhere each week. You know, the straight model for that is Star Trek for sure. I'm going to back up a second, but for anyone who's not that familiar with Futurama, Fry is the main character, and he was a pizza delivery boy in 1999 in New York City, and he accidentally got frozen and woke up in the year 3000 and becomes a delivery boy again, but this time for an interstellar package delivery service. But having this character who was around in our time, again, is an excuse to sometimes do pop culture things or references that wouldn't make sense if nobody from our era was there. So one of the biggest moments when we got to see that in the show was a memorable Star Trek-themed episode. We got most of the original cast, Shatner and Nimoy and everyone, Shatner, Nimoy, Nichelle Nichols, George Takei, and Walter Koenig were all on the episode. So we learned in that episode that Star Trek fanatics had actually formed a religion over the intervening thousand years that had been banned because it had gotten too powerful. And so Fry was the one who didn't know about this, and he got them in trouble by mentioning the word Star Trek and found out that the characters' heads were still alive, being held prisoner at a perpetual Star Trek convention on another planet. So I won't. That's enough details, but suffice it to say, yes, having Fry be a Star Trek fan allowed us to explore some of these things that we just wanted to write about, and we needed a flimsy excuse, and that was it.
Right, right. There is definitely this rueful, ironic laughter that's built right into Futurama. Were you thinking Stanislaw Lem on that front? Or is that just more part of what your makeup?
Yeah, I didn't specifically go, I like the tone of that, those books. I mean, I love the tone of those books, but I didn't think that's the model for the whole series. I just thought that's an inspiration to me in general. There was one specific episode I should credit straight inspiration from Stanislaw Lem, which is this one where the Planet Express crew visits a planet inhabited only by robots. Mm-hmm. And that's straight out, you know, Stanislaw Lem did a lot of stuff with worlds that are populated only by robots. And so we kind of did our take on that scenario. So that, yeah, straight out of there. But the general attitude, I guess you're talking about kind of the we're beaten down figures in a big universe is, I think that's just kind of what it evolved into. And to what degree it came from me, I guess, is me, the beaten down guy who's trying to achieve something.
Oh, that's great. Do you think that science fiction is different when you remove humans? Do you think non-human characters allow you to tell even more varied stories or hold a different lens up to us?
Ultimately, I think it's always a disguise for humans. You know, how else could we understand anything, you know? Yeah. So I think it lets you tell interesting stories, but I think it's always some kind of reflection on
You said people. That Bender's the most human character on the ship.
Yes, he is. He has every human vice. He smokes, he drinks, he likes robot pornography, which is like circuit diagrams and you know, stuff like that. So, but we could get away with a lot more. So this is part of what it is. You can do things that you would feel uneasy doing with a person. So we didn't want to show, you know, people smoking all the time, for example.
Right.
But on the other hand, it seemed kind of funny that Bender, if he's going to have every vice, he kind of has to smoke, or else we've only gone halfway. So we're like, okay, but he's a robot, so he's powered a little bit by hot smoke and burning alcohol, and so that was always our excuse. He's doing things that are not good for people.
When you're working on the DNA of a show like that, are there problems with the overall structure of the show, with its subversiveness or with its attitude?
Yeah, there were a few things about just, is the future too dark? Which our attitude always was, a lot of the things you see about the future go all the way one way or the other. It's either a kind of a utopia or it is a total dystopia.
And the utopias are few and far between, Star Trek being the main one.
Right. But we thought, well, the way comedy works is you need to be able to comment on life today. So we need to have everything in there. You know, it's got to be like the world today. There's good people, there's bad people, and there's evil and good in the world. Yeah. So, you know, we did have some things that were kind of dark, and specifically the coin-operated suicide booth, for example. In the future, for 25 cents, you can go into a booth and commit suicide. And nice, you know, it's quick and easy. Bender was very mean at the beginning, but that kind of went by the wayside when he became popular. So, you know, it just took a while to realize, oh, he's not necessarily so much mean as he's just out for himself. You know, whatever he's doing, whatever he wants to do at that moment. And that means he's not always considerate of other people. But on the other hand, that's a character who's fun to watch. People like to see people who have no inhibitions or robots.
Yes, they do. Now, with Futurama, you were also able to indulge in some of your sci-fi fan dreams, like making that Star Trek episode. What are your top memories of working with your science and science fiction heroes?
Well, I'll describe that Star Trek one first, because that's probably the most memorable, particularly that we had Shatner and Nimoy came into the studio at the same time.
Crazy.
And it paid off big time, because, you know, they were very happy to see each other and goofing around, and we just kind of left the mic rolling and some of their takes are overlapping stuff. So recorded in a much, in a more haphazard way than we would normally record things. Not only super exciting for me, but of course, all of our writers wanted to meet these guys. Yeah. And like, well, we can't have our, you know, 12 people in the studio staring at them. So I said, hide in the engineer's booth and just kind of, you know, poke up a little bit and then, but don't show yourselves till they're done. So we know they don't get, you know, overwhelmed. And the second it was done, the door just like blasted open from the pressure of human bodies in there. And everybody came running out and surrounding them. And they were very courteous and took a lot of pictures. And so that was super exciting. Again, like no, I want to be clear, no bigger influence as far as sci-fi goes on me and the structure of Futurama. So very exciting. And then Stephen Hawking, if I were allowed to go into...
He was on the show more than...
He was on the show 3 times. So this is, again, extreme high point of my career. But the first time he was actually a visiting professor at Caltech. So we contacted him to see if he wanted to do the show. He said yes. And he obviously could have just emailed us his dialogue because it's, you know, machine generated. Yeah. But no, he wants to see what the process is. So he says, bring a portable recording setup to my house. And I got to meet him in person and put him in front of a mic. And he had programmed the lines in advance to save a little time. But I got to talk to him a little bit. Somehow the subject of like unlucky numbers came up. And I remember him commenting that at a lot of universities, the physics department is on the 13th floor because they're the people who always don't care, right? So anyway, it's a huge honor and pleasure for me. And subsequently, he just emailed the staff once he got the gist of it. But you can hear even now, I'm a little bit giddy about it.
And, yeah. Have you had any actual astronauts, any NASA scientists?
Yeah, Buzz Aldrin. We had an episode where we had a lot of flashbacks to Fry's childhood. We were in a science fair and Buzz Aldrin was involved. So yes, we got Buzz Aldrin. He also came in person to the studio. That is another example where everybody showed up. We were talking to him. I remember one of our other writers, Ken Keeler, who's who had a big science background, he asked this question. Well, when you're coming down, landing the moon, and Neil Armstrong was controlling the lander and you were running low on fuel and repositioning, were you getting nervous at all? And Buzz Aldrin said, Armstrong was pretty good. you know, even these small things becomes the fact that I get to hear that personally from him. Very
amazing.
Very exciting.
With your science fiction upbringing and personal studies, I imagine that you keep a close eye on how the facts are handled in sci-fi.
I'm very critical of sci-fi. So my thing when I see sci-fi movies is that usually I enjoy them, but I still am a big nitpicker.
You're a science nitpicker.
I'm a science nitpicker.
So that's what'll pull you, but that's your pet peeve.
And that's the thing. That's the thing I feel like we can dodge by being a comedy sci-fi show with Futurama, where I feel like, okay, we try to signal people that we know we're getting it wrong, but it's wrong, but for the sake of the joke. But with straight sci-fi, I am a big nitpicker, so I always get bugged by that, but I can't help it. I am a nitpicking science nerd.
And speaking of real science fiction, you have some real science. You have a theorem. There's a Futurama theorem?
Yes. We were talking about an episode which had a classic cartoon premise of people's minds getting switched. So it's you know, all our characters' brains were getting switched by a brain-switching machine. And we thought, well, that's, you know, been done a million times going back to Scooby-Doo and before probably. And so we thought, well, what can we do to give it a more sci-fi twist? And we thought, well, let's complicate it by having this brain switching machine be a one-way machine where if you've ever switched brains with somebody, you cannot switch back. So it's like, if I switch brains with you, maybe I can get my brain back by switching it to you, to another person, and then back to me. But then we thought, wait a second, if everyone gets their brains scrambled up, is it even possible for them to get their original brains back? Or are we going to always hit a roadblock? So we were talking about this in the
afternoon. Game of musical chairs with brains.
Yeah, and so we went home for the night literally not knowing the answer to that question. So we come in the next morning, Ken Keeler walks in, he says, I proved a theorem! He pounds his fist on the table. He proceeds to prove the theorem for us. And the theorem, to state it simply, is no matter how many people mixed up their brains, no matter how complex a mess, as long as you can bring in two new people, two fresh people, has to be two, though, who have never had their brain switched, then you can get everybody, including those two people, back to their original
brain,
back to their body. So I thought, we have to use the theorem in the show. So luckily, we have the future Harlem Globetrotters traveling basketball-playing mathematicians in Futurama. So we had them team up with our character, the professor, and prove this theorem at the climactic moment of the show. And no other show is having the climax of their episode being the proof of mathematical theorem. And my philosophy was, we're going to put the real math in there, in this and many other cases, but we'll put it in a way which doesn't derail people who don't want to see it. So we put it up on a hovering hollow chalkboard, and we showed it on screen, but for about a quarter of a second, I would say. So people could see there was something real there, and if they were dedicated enough, they could go back and look at it, which they did. So that's the Futurama theorem.
When you began, I'm certain you didn't set out to inspire a mathematical theorem. What is your creative starting point?
The characters are definitely the starting point of most of it. And Matt's mantra going into Futurama was, you can put the characters in any crazy science fiction situation you want, but they have to react like real humans would react. And that, when I say real humans, that could be a giant lobster or a robot, or it does not have to actually be a human. But, you know, his philosophy, which I subscribe to, is that for people to buy into the world, the people have to be reacting in a believable way. And that's something I think, for me, when I watch sci-fi, even non-comedy sci-fi, the same thing applies. If something freaky happens, they have to be freaked out. Or if their lives are in danger, they have to be horrified. Or, you know, if their loved one is missing, they have to be searching for them. Whatever. So human-driven.
But still within this framework of science fiction.
Yeah. So then it's like, okay, so developing the show with Matt, we started out with, we know we're going to have the ship traveling around, but we need to know who we're going to care about and who's the emotion about. And there's some things I'm proud of about Futurama that where we took that a little further, I think, and actually in a way that we didn't originally envision, we went very emotional with some of the episodes. And
famously emotional.
We weren't really talking about that at the beginning. We're like, well, it's a comedy, it's a science fiction, these people have their concerns, but we didn't say, like, let's do a heartbreaking episode where people cry.
When you started writing a heartbreaking episode, did you think, I want to get emotion out of this? That was the goal?
Yeah, in the third season, an idea came up for a show where Fry was going to learn the fate of his brother, who he had never found out what had happened to his long-lost brother. And the episode's called The Luck of the Fryerish for any Futurama fans out there. And we started talking about it, and we're like, well, we're going to go do the episode in two time periods. We're going to go back and see Fry's childhood and what his brother was like, and then back to what he's learning in the future. And we're going to go back and forth. And as we're talking about it, it's like, wow, it seems like a very emotional subject. And just the natural discussion led to this kind of very touching ending. And we were talking about it. Can we, you know, should we do this? It's not, you know, it's not pure comedy, really. There's a lot of crazy stuff happening in the way, but the end is pretty much a straight up, you know, tear-jerking moment. Yeah. And so it was really an experiment, and got the episode ended up getting a really good reaction from the fans. So that gave us the confidence to try that about once per year, I would say, where we would go for the tears. I was really scouring the internet after that aired to see what people thought. And the funniest one was like, I hate you, Futurama. I am so angry. How could you make me cry at the end of a cartoon? And I think like, well, I feel kind of proud of that, because it's like, if you can get people to care enough about your crazy comedy sci-fi cartoon that they actually cried even one measly tear at the end, I feel like that means they were buying into it in the way we were hoping, that they're thinking of these as real people. So I always feel very proud of those moments where you got some genuine emotion out of somebody in such a crazy world. I think it's a higher degree of difficulty than if it's a family and you know, the mom dies. That's too easy. But if it's the future and you're going back and forth thousands of years and stuff, feel like you've succeeded in a challenge.
Well, it also must be because the characters are real to you.
There's one thing that I kind of realized also over the course of years of working in Futurama is that time travel, which is sort of equivalent to cutting back and forth in time, but has a few more options. But time travel is intrinsically connected to very strong emotions. And
interesting.
And you think of, well, that's a crazy sci-fi conceit, but actually a lot of emotion has to do with time passing, and it's like, oh, remembering your childhood or remembering people who died or, you know, people you're not going to see again. And so time travel intrinsically sets up these situations where you are separated in time from the things you care about. And so it's actually it's a good setup for emotional stuff. But I didn't really realize that at the beginning, but then we did another episode, which was an Emmy-winning episode. I'll hype up Futurama a little more, but called The Late Philip J. Fry, where Fry and a couple of our other characters get on this one-way time machine that can only move into the future. And he becomes separated from Leela, his coworker who he loves, and he's getting further and further and further from her. but she seemingly can never go back. And it's like, that's a great emotional setup. And so sometimes you stumble on things that, oh, as far removed as they seem from our world, are actually tied in nicely to our lives.
You've taken animated science fiction comedy to some pretty deep places. What worlds do you seek to conquer next?
I have a couple ideas for live-action sci-fi movies that I may give a go at some point.
And specifically within sci-fi, like, this is your genre.
Yes, and it's funny, like, you kind of get into things by accident along the way, and so I was originally pretty interested in science fiction, but I wasn't planning to be a writer, and then I became a pure comedy writer, but then I accidentally got into this comedy sci-fi, and that could be, you know, maybe I can go all the way back and do some straight-up science fiction, so I think I have a pretty good idea, actually, but it's just like, when do I do this? You know, I'm used to dealing with 22-minute chunks of TV material, so it's a little more daunting to write 2 hours of epic sci-fi stuff and get someone to spend $100 and whatever million to do it.
Well, now you can do it on your phone.
That's true, yeah. Just cut a few corners.
Clearly, science fiction is super important to you. Why do you think science fiction and fantasy are so important to us culturally?
For me, I can tell you why for me, and maybe this will resonate with somebody out there. When I read, I like to feel like I went somewhere, like I've gone out of my own life for a little while and gotten to experience something which I don't normally experience. When I finish a book and I really liked it, I always feel like I went somewhere and I was not in our world for a while. And I think just that feeling is strongest when you're literally not in our world you know, you're in a place where the laws of physics might be different, or it's hundreds of years from now, or just something. I'm in a place which I could never experience in my real life. And I can't quite have that feeling if I'm reading something that takes place in our world. I can enjoy it, but it just that particular feeling, which is what I'm looking for, is strongest, I think, with sci-fi.
Science fiction literature is still considered this sort of lesser genre. Mm-hmm. Why do you think that is?
Most of my reading is science fiction.
Yeah.
And I know what you mean. I've grown up with this. If you ask me, are you reading fine literature? I say, no, I'm reading science fiction. But then, why isn't that literature? That it's a good question. And I'm sure it reflects on me also, where it's like, oh, yeah, he didn't write. He did cartoons. And cartoons are the same thing, by the way. So it's like cartoon writer, science fiction writer. Yeah. One step down from the noble drama writer.
Are you optimistic about the future? Does science fiction help you envision that humans are going to not?
It's my only overly hope, really, because I feel, I mean, I grew up in the 80s largely and have a terror of nuclear weapons, and I still do. I'm not going to lose it. To me, that's our hope, is like, can we make some of the science fiction come true? Do you have kids like I do that you want to think? I don't want to be a 100% pessimist. You have to find what is your optimism. So it's like, okay, hopefully technology and the spirit of wanting to know more will take us to these places and make us safer instead of more dead in the future.
Well, I mean, having dedicated your life to building narratives that help to show people in a better light, it seems like you're trying to help us along.
I'd like to think so. You know, having given up science, I do feel guilty sometimes. Like, wow, maybe I could have done something to add to mankind's knowledge, or, you know, am I elevating us as a species? You know, that's always been the more noble goal in life to me. And that's what's great about science. So maybe indirectly, if we can inspire people, maybe went into science. So maybe I can be a stepping stone and they can grind their dirty boot on me and lift up the species a little bit.
David X. Cohen, you've made science fiction a better, funnier place. But before we let the world use you as a stepping stone, I've got a lightning round of some either-or questions for you. Are you ready?
I'm ready.
Here we go. Kang or Kodos?
Kodos.
Okay. Full brain emulation or head in a jar?
I'm going to go with the emulation, because I feel like if you can emulate my brain, you might be able to emulate a world that I'm in, whereas to be locked in a pickle jar seems a little depressing.
Utopia or dystopia?
I got to take utopia.
Yeah.
That's not a choice.
Sloppy Jimbo or Soylent Coleslaw?
I'll go for Soylent Coleslaw.
Hyperloop or New York Tube?
I'm going to take the Hyperloop because it might be real and I might get to ride it.
Yeah, I know. I'm excited about that. And lastly, coffee or Slurm?
I'm sitting here with a cup of coffee, as I always am at all hours of my life. So as much as I like Slurm, if you want to know something about the real David X. Cohen, I am a diehard coffee addict. So,
David X. Cohen, thank you so much for coming on the podcast. It's been
really
a delight.
Fun.
My thanks to David X. Cohen and to all of you for listening to Sci-Fi 25 Origin Stories, powered by Sci-Fi Wire. Be sure to check out our other episodes with wonderful guests like Nnedi Okorafor, Kevin Smith, Doug Chang, and Ron Moore. For more about the podcast, please visit us at sci-fi.com.